Page 36, side 1, continuation of Monday, April 2nd, 1:30 p.m., room 350, full committee, public hearing, and work session on HB 2271, 2356, 2827, 2810, 2905. Okay. As I was saying, I see a problem that might come up with the issue of trial by jury. I believe it's line 24 on the second page. As I understand it, it would be best to probably just take that out altogether. Probably help the bill go through. I guess I could close now. Basically, what I had to say is that individuals as well as the mental health department do not operate within a vacuum. The psychiatric establishment is powerful and quite often accepted force in molding, judging, and defining an individual's behavior as deviant or valuable within the political, economic, and social context. As a result, state laws regarding civil commitment, care, custody, and treatment of mental health patients are often inadequate and unjust. This bill in its present form would do much to improve the status and rights of patients and persons subject to such proceedings. It also helps to favorably diminish the authority of the MHD in exercising immense power and control over such persons. I urge the committee to consider my recommendation for due pass vote. Thank you, and if you have any questions.
Questions for the witness? Thank you. Okay. Is there anyone else to testify on House Bill 2905? You first.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Laverne Taylor. I'm what they call the district counsel for the Veterans Administration. That means I'm the lawyer in charge of legal services for the Veterans Administration in Oregon, and as such, I'm supposed to maintain liaison with the state legislature and speak for the VA concerning legislation of interest to us. All of these bills that you have here today are of interest to us. You had a lot of conversation on some of them. I thought perhaps I could give some insight of our position on 2905, which we oppose, speaking from 20 years of experience in dealing with people who are alleged to be incapacitated civilly or due to a physical infirmity or mental problem. I can say that it looks an awful lot different out in the real world than it does in the legislative arena. And I could recount some real horror stories, not only about what happens when the system goes wrong, but in trying to get the present law implemented as it is written. It would be, I believe, interesting to you to know how often the local police bring a private citizen involuntarily to one of our hospitals and want us to accept him and then put him under a physician hold for a commitment. Clearly illegal, no legal support at all, and the preoccupation with things like the rights of patients to subject to hearsay evidence becomes rather academic when you see such flagrant disregard of basic citizens' rights. This proposal here that would require three petitioners to sign a petition for commitment is, it would seem to me, this kind of thing. As a practical matter, often it is extremely difficult to obtain one signer. The implication seems to be that the signers of a petition are against the patient, and that once the patient has a petition signed, bad things happen to him, as if the worst thing that can happen is that he's going to get treatment which a reasonable medical judgment says he ought to get. There are worse things. Within the legal world, we see that in California, the lawyers have recognized it's easier to get a guardian for an incapacitated person than it is a conservator. And it's a lot harder to get rid of a guardian than it is to get out of a commitment. So if it is made too difficult to commit a patient, we're going to find patients being given guardians. Some of the stories that we heard from individual people here this afternoon as to problems that they had with their family. clearly could have been obviated by petitioning for appointment of a guardian of the person. Once they have control of the disposition of this person, they can put him in the hospital. But as a practical... Pardon?
Representative Cohen.
I have a question. Who pays when they put him in the hospital?
When who put him in the hospital?
I'm just repeating your statement. You say they could put him in the hospital.
Okay, the guardian does. The estate of the incapacitated person pays if there is an adequate estate. If there's not an adequate estate, the state pays. Okay, but the assumption is that these signers are antagonistic to this person's interests, and therefore we need to further safeguard those interests by requiring more signers. As a practical matter, it's his close friends and relatives who are the signers. They are the ones who know his problems, and they are the ones who turn in desperation to the court for a commitment. And to increase the number of signers to 3 wouldn't do anything but make it tougher on the people who are trying to get help for this person. I think that the jury trial is a similar kind of concern. One of the things that we've encountered, an interesting problem concerning the number of signers, is that in some counties of the state, the judges have the conception that the signers to the petition must appear in court at the time of the hearing. And the VA has encountered a difficulty because where we have 2 physicians who sign the petition, the judge requires both of those physicians to appear in court and sit there for a half a day without being permitted to testify under the doctor-patient relationship. Now, this is stultifying, and it really doesn't make sense. Yet, this kind of effort, I think, would probably be better directed to clarifying and implementing the present law, and certainly this requirement of 3 signers instead of 2 and to provide for a jury trial really is a stultifying effort.
Questions for witness? Thank you.
Richard Schwartz is my name, and I shall be very brief here and address simply 2 points. First is that Representative Mason brought this up before. I think that the committee should take a long look at the level of care available right now. We are talking about seriously disturbed people, and they are getting less individual attention in state institutions than a private doctor would give to somebody who was neurotic or not quite so seriously disturbed. There are people in the wards. There is a psychiatrist present in the hospital to oversee occupational therapy, recreational activity, but there is no, to speak of, individual work being done with these people. They are simply not receiving real help. And to imagine that, to commit someone is to give them real psychiatric assistance, I think is an error. Secondly, to address in particular this bill, to allow someone to refuse to take psychotropic drugs, not to prohibit the use of them, but to allow someone to refuse them, I think there's an analogy with ECT here, with electroconvulsive therapy, in that right now the treatment of choice may be these drugs. As to what their long-range effects on the human mind and body are, we don't know. And I simply think that the committee should take a long look at whether or not, in other words, 20, 30 years ago, the treatment of choice might have been, in a particular instance, lobotomy. It is no longer the treatment of choice. I think it behooves the committee to use an overview and to try and include some foresight in their deliberation, and I strongly support the idea that a patient should be able to refuse mind-altering drugs. Anyone who has worked with these patients has heard them say, I'd rather feel crazy than not feel at all. And I think it's a valid point of view.
Question. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else to testify in House Bill 2905?
Ed Kolbach again. As I sit listening to all of these, I think you're all aware of this, but I'll make it clear. The people who would seem to add more legalism to our process generally come from the legal field or newspaper field or something like that. What we hear are those people who are supposed to treat and those people who are relatives of mentally ill. They want to do away with the legalistic approach. I think that's been very clear. If you think about our witnesses today, those people are intimately involved. They're saying, hey, give us some relief from all these legalisms. Those who come at it from more of a theoretical viewpoint, who maybe have had a little experience arguing a few cases before a judge, they would like to add more legalistic roadblocks. I think that's all I really wanted to say.
Thank you. Anyone else? I'll now move to House Bill 2776.
I gave a paper for you to read. I'll just tell you what it is. And
could you identify yourself?
Identify
the case,
myself.
Please.
My paper is I'm Nelda Grover. I'm the parent of a boy with schizophrenia who's been in hospitals for 15 years and mental health clinic before that for 5 years. So it's been nearly 20 years now that we've been through this. I won't read this because of the lateness of the hour, but most of you aren't here, but I hope they will read it. This is an account of our son's 2 mental hearings in 1 week. I would hope by your listening to this, it might possibly prevent someone else from going through the same things. It shows some problems parents have involuntary commitment problems. Our son, 34, first committed in 1964, and where he stayed 13 months, and he is still, every year, goes back to the hospital for so many months, 4 to 7. Some of the questions I asked at the end, why was it necessary? We were beaten up between the first and second hearing. that's part of the sad tale. Why is it necessary for parents to be beaten up to get medical help for our chronically mentally ill son? I think they have a right to treatment. This is what I'm so, my husband's a counselor, and he hears all about the rights of juveniles, you know, and adolescents. Well, I think sometimes we're going too far for the rights of mental patients so far that we don't remember that they also have a right to treatment. When they're acutely ill, there's only one place our boy can go, and that's to the hospital. And sometimes he asks to go to the hospital. We don't have to. I think the reason this came up is that we were unaware and just hadn't kept up with the new law, because somebody else had committed him from a hotel because of something he did, and then one time he said, will you drive me down to damage? So that I think that a lot of people think that we all twist their arm and force them into mental hearings. That is not true. On this same line, too, I just have just a very few points to make. Our son and the son of I'm also secretary of this TMED group, the parents group. One of the other board members' son and our son went down to, when they left the hospital, went down to Southwest Oregon to be in a nursing home with Father Will Augsburger, who is an Episcopal priest and a nurse. And this has provided a very good in-between thing. So what Portland needs is they need a lot of Father Augsburgers up here. They really do, because there's only one home in Multnomah County, and 33% of the patients come from this county. I wonder, too, why, after our son has been treated for 15 years in state hospitals, 2 mental health clinics, with all doctors agreeing on the diagnosis, can't we have his medical history reviewed by doctors, or a judge if that's proper, or perhaps it isn't, but at least by the doctors before the hearing? Mental patients can be great actors, and many are very clever and very intelligent. Bizarre this without judgment. I feel this way. I'm sure my cardiologist feels he'd make a more accurate diagnosis, knowing that I had rheumatic fever at age 26 and 27, and that I'm often under stress and pressure from dealing with our chronically disabled son. Medical history is important. Why is it not important for mental patients at mental hearings? Now, I think it's extremely important.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. One other thing I forgot to say. The 2 boys that went down there, they missed damage. They missed the swimming pool and all the things. Father Will didn't have any of those things, and they didn't feel it was so bad as damage when they were ill. So not all of them feel that they're closed in, locked up, and everything. They really have quite a bit of freedom at damage. Salem is another thing. Our son was there. He was locked up there. Damage, they're not that locked up.
Thank you. Move out to House Bill 2776. Mr. Snyder, you've been waiting very patiently.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Paul Snyder. I'm with Ted Hughes and Associates. We represent the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, and the Oregon Peace Officers Association. I have provided the committee with 3 documents through the legal counsel to the committee, one of which is a copy of a letter from the Sheriff of Benton County, which we received in December, providing some reasons for the bill which was ultimately written. A second is a copy of the federal law which currently is in effect. Third is a copy of some proposed amendments to the bill which our association has tendered. In the interest of time, I won't read the letter from the Sheriff of Benton County. Suffice it to say that it does provide some particular examples which we have responded to in the form of legislation. The second enclosure is a copy of the federal law. The citation to that law, I'm not sure whether your enclosure is underlined, it's section 178.164. In that provision, a cogent section of it prohibits the ownership possession of firearms by, among other individuals, a person who has been adjudged by a court of the United States or of a state or any political subdivision thereof as being mentally incompetent. One of the problems that we deal with in Oregon is that my understanding is that under ORS 426-295, subsection 1, although an individual has been found to be mentally ill under that statute, there is under that section a presumption that the individual is not mentally incompetent. I question, therefore, whether an individual who is committed in Oregon would fall within the provisions of the federal statute. One other case study which provides reasons for the legislation that we've offered is not contained in the Benton County Sheriff's letter, and I'd like to just simply relate that briefly to you. It's a fact situation which was given to us through Douglas County District Attorney and also through Douglas County Sheriff's Office. My understanding from those facts is that an individual was committed in Idaho under facts which involved what in Oregon would be the charge of menacing. Subsequent to that, the individual was committed again to Eastern Oregon State Hospital as a result of a fact situation which arose in Wasco County. Under that situation, he apparently got into a gun battle with another individual. The other individual lost. After that commitment, apparently in June of 1978, that same individual was involved in an incident under which he shot three Douglas County deputies of the Douglas County Sheriff's Office. All three of these situations apparently arose involving the same weapon, a .44 Magnum pistol, and Douglas County is concerned with trying to provide some legislative solutions to that particular problem. In response to these concerns, we drafted House Bill 2776. After a close scrutiny of the bill, we had originally drafted it to conform basically with the provisions of the federal statute. In looking at the bill, however, we offer some amendments, which I believe legal counsel has. And the purpose of these amendments is to restrict the operation of the bill only to the individuals with whom we're concerned. The amendments would do this. It would change the definition of the individual to whom the prohibition applies. It would apply first to an individual who's been found not responsible due to mental disease or defect for a crime in the commission of which possession or use of a firearm was involved. And the individual has been placed under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board pursuant to the applicable statutes. Now, my understanding of those statutes is that the court makes a determination that but for this mental disease or defect, the individual would probably have been found guilty of that particular crime. The individual is committed to the jurisdiction of the review board for the same amount as would be the maximum sentence if the individual had been found guilty of that crime. The second fact situation under which this prohibition would apply involves the mental commitment situation, which the original draft involved, but it's more restrictive. Under ORS 426-005, subsection 2, an individual may be mentally committed for either of two reasons. One is that the individual is a threat to himself or others. The other is that the individual is unable to take care for his personal needs. We restrict the provisions of our prohibition against carrying firearms to an individual who's been committed for the reason that the person is a threat to himself or others. It would also only apply during the period of time that the individual is under the jurisdiction of the Mental Health Division pursuant to that commitment. So in the first instance, we're including only individuals who have been committed to the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board at any time. The second applies to an individual who has been mentally committed for the reason that he's a threat to himself or others. This prohibition would only apply during the period of time that he's actually under the custody of the mental health division.
Question?
Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Suka, Dr. Bloom?
Joseph Bloom. The proposed amendments to the bill, I think, clean up the bill quite a bit from objections that we originally had to it. I think we would need time to review this and perhaps submit some letter to the committee regarding the our opinion as a Department of Psychiatry in relationship to this bill.
Yeah, there's no great rush with this bill to come out of the committee, so it'll be held over for a period of time, and you can get a copy of the proposed amendments from staff. And please submit a letter. We appreciate it.
Just in terms of procedures, does a proposed amendment, does this become, what? How does this work in relation to the bill?
Something will be taken up and considered by the committee, but where the sponsors of the bill basically come in and ask the bill be put in that form, if the bill is going to come out at all, probably it would be put in that form.
So we would be safe to work with this?
Correct.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Fosterling?
Getting
shorter each time.
That's correct. Director of the Involuntary Commitment Program for Multnomah County, and speaking for testimony for Ron Milstein, who's director of the Multnomah County Mental Health Division. We are opposed to this bill, but I find it rather awkward. It's a little bit like coming out in favor of arming the mentally ill or the criminal. We're not, but we do see some difficulty in how you enforce this kind of action, particularly with those who are civilly committed. They obviously have serious mental illness. I'm probably more concerned about them prior to the time we get them into a court and into a hospital, perhaps, than I am afterwards. I think later they're perhaps less dangerous than they are beforehand. I don't know, once they have been committed, however, and once we're monitoring them back in the mental health system, I'm not sure who enforces this proposal and how you take action on it, and what do you do, whether you have a process then of jailing a mentally ill person, or what happens. So it's, part of this is confusion, and part of it we think it's a poorly written bill and needs to be a little more specific as to what it plans to accomplish. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Joe Trelevin, Assistant Administrator of Mental Health Division. I submitted some written comments about the bill in its original form. I presume they're relevant. Anyway, for the record, I'd like the committee to have those comments. We thought the bill in its original form was very bad. It gives me a great deal of pleasure to come here and testify for the rights of the mentally ill. For 27 years I've been a psychiatrist, I thought I'd been an advocate of them, but I think some of those proposals you've heard, I have to argue again. About the amended version of the bill, I'd like to point out that the people that are under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board are not under the jurisdiction of the Mental Health Division. And I would think that the Psychiatric Security Review Board has enough authority to prevent people from carrying arms or owning arms if they thought that was necessary, and I suggest you leave that up to them.
Thank you. Anyone else to testify on 2776? Okay. We move now to House Bill 2271. Barry Sheldahl, see here. Dr. Blue.
Joseph Bloom again, House Bill 2271, we would
be opposed to removing the at least the provision that a district attorney be available upon request. We feel that there are legitimate state interests in civil commitment, although not all the district attorneys feel that way. We feel that the district attorneys have added some balance to some of the hearings in terms of balancing off state versus individual interests, and have made the hearings a much truer type of legal hearing. Several weeks ago, I got a brief survey from the Mental Health Division in which they called counties and asked them if this provision was actually being used. There's some reference to that in that paper that we gave you a little bit earlier, but a more current, up-to-date thing is that 10 counties have never used the district attorney provision, 7 occasionally, 5 usually, and 14 always. So that a number of counties are finding it a help, and I think to remove it for those counties would be a mistake. I think the Multnomah County people should try and work out their problems on the local level.
Questions to witness? Thank you. Mr. Foster?
Charles Fostering, Multnomah County Mental Health, take the Salon Milk Team Director. We strongly oppose this bill on the basis that having the district attorney present has allowed much more information into the system than was ever available before. I've sat through hearings and participated in them now for something like 4.5 years, both without the district attorney present and with one present. What happened before was a process in which the attorney for the allegedly mentally ill person working in supposedly the best interest of that person did his best to get him out of the commitment. And at times information was lacking, problems came up that were not addressed. And it turned into a process in which it was adversary without there being another attorney present. I've watched the judge become the adversary in this. I've seen the court examiners and family members put in that adversary role. I would like to read one brief paragraph from the Willamette Law Journal, Volume 2, page 324. An article by Jeff Mutnick and Lazar, and in this they make a brief point in which they say, although a civil commitment proceeding is not strictly an adversary proceeding, counsel for the allegedly mentally ill person is in effect the adversary of the judge who must make the decision whether to deprive a person of liberty through an adjudication of mental illness. And this does indeed happen and has in the past, and I think it puts the judge in a very awkward position and is ill-advised for a good process. Thank you.
Questions? Thanks. Dr. Trelawney?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Joe Trelawney, Assistant Administrator, State Mental Health Division. I'm testifying on behalf of the Mental Health Division. The division wishes to oppose this bill for the reasons that you've already heard in testimony. We think that there are occasions, particularly where the individual is a threat to public safety, where you need the system balanced with somebody representing the interests of the public. Also, the district attorney's office is used to issue subpoenas for witnesses, to prepare witnesses, and to assist them in presenting preparing their testimony. And there's no other persons in the system that have that ability. And so we think that when it's needed, it should be still available to counties.
Questions for the witness? Thank you. Judge Beatty is gone. Is there anyone else here testifying in House 2271? I think you got your hand up first.
exactly. Being a Stolzberg and a psychiatrist, I'm also an expert witness through the Multnomah County Probate Court on a weekly basis, which, and have been a witness for them since 1975. So I've sat through the hearings both with a DA and without a DA. I agree with everything that the previous witnesses have testified to, but want to raise one additional point, which is that without the district attorney, very frequently the people that are left accusing, if you will, the person of being mentally ill are their own family and friends, and that after the smoke and fire of the hearing dies down, it's the same family and friends that are left to take care of the person. And because of the atmosphere that's been created, this causes tremendous rifts and difficulty with trust, so that once again, the families bear the responsibility and take it in the neck because of the legalism of the proceeding. Thank you.
Thank you. Colbeck again, and I got some mixed feelings about this.
I've been going to mental hearings since 1965 until I started boycotting them 2 years ago because I couldn't stand them anymore. But in 65, they were relatively informal. There were two physicians, there were a judge, and the allegedly mentally ill person. And I thought we made pretty good decisions. Now, we've inflated the process tremendously. I don't know who's been to a hearing recently, but there's about 12 people in the room. Recently, we've added a prosecuting attorney, a district attorney. And I just wonder about all this. I think it adds, makes for a more balanced hearing. But again, we're into a criminal proceeding where take a paranoid person sitting there and there's attorneys fighting over him and he wonders what's going on. And I guess I just protest the whole legalistic invasion of these male hearings, including the district attorney's presence.
I just think the comments, at least you're consistent. The other people who are asking it, who's not be deleted, have also generally been the people who testify that they want the criminal aspect out of it.
That's
anyone else testify in House of 2271? Yes, ma'am.
Just make one further comment that we would like to get all the legalisms out of it, but the only thing presented here is to take one side of it, and that makes it impossible. I agree with Dr. Colbeck, but that's not an option at the moment.
I've examined House Bill 2351. I think the issues that are raised by that bill are substantially similar, if not identical, to House Bill. Can you remember the number? 2438. So, unless someone is just dying to testify on that bill, at this point I would not bring it up for public hearing.
We have Multnomah County Medical Center, but they left.
You're not dying to testify. Okay. Is there anyone dying to testify? How's the point?
I'd be glad to read you some testimony because if you consider it further, there are certain points that we have objection to in there that we would like you to look at. But if you're not going to consider it further, there's no point taking your time.
If any bill comes out of the committee with House Bill 2438 in some form, House Bill 2251 will be here.
Well, this is a little too rough.
Okay. Is there any further business to come before the committee? If not, let me just say that I appreciate the witnesses hanging in there and the committee that remains hanging in there. We are adjourned.
636-52, House Committee on Judiciary, April 4th, 8:30 a.m., Room 350, Subcommittee 1, Public Hearing and Work Session on HB 2718, SB 161.
Yeah. Oh, Bob was saying it first. I thought he'd...
I had a good idea.
House Subcommittee on the Judiciary comes to order. The clerk will note the attendance present at the balance for excuse. The first item up on the agenda for public hearing is House Bill 2718. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Norm Smith, State Representative from House District 7 in Washington County, and with me at the witness table is Francis Smith, who is my father-in-law partner, who also, in our office, does a considerable amount of probate work. There are some other witnesses here today, including, I think, the originator of this bill, who will speak to it. It's not new to the committee, but it relates to small estates. House Bill 2718 has been before this committee in previous years, as I say. In 1973, the original conception of ORS 114.505 to .555 was enacted, which established the small estate procedure to simplify the closing of estates of a relatively small value. Rather than going through a formal probate procedure, usually requiring the services of an attorney and at least one court hearing, the small estate can be handled by an affidavit of one or more of the heirs filed with the county clerk. The affidavit contains specified information, including the assets and liabilities of the decedent, a list of the heirs, and a copy of the will if there is one. Copies of the affidavit are delivered to all the heirs in the Adult and Family Services Division. The 1973 law limited use of this procedure to estates with a value of under $5,000. Last session, with no dissenting votes, at the request of the Oregon State Bar, some technical changes in the law were made which doubled the value of the small estate, that is to say, raised the limits of the small estate to $10,000. House Bill 2718 increases the small estate value from $10,000 aggregate to $30,000 aggregate, of which no more than $10,000 can be personal property and no more than $20,000 can be real property. This increase is responsive to the general inflation in real and personal property values and would relieve the growing burden on courts by channeling more estates through simpler affidavit procedure. I spoke with one of the Multnomah County probate clerks, who was very much in favor of the bill. Her impression is that very seldom is real estate valued at under $10,000, and the proposed figure is closer to being realistic. And I'm sure that members of the committee and staff would recognize that a simple lot to build a home on now can cost $20,000, $25,000, a bare lot. Talked with Clackamas County Probate Administrator, who strongly feels that increasing the limits, as this bill would do, would greatly help the common person. The Washington County Probate Administrator is of the opinion that the limits proposed in House Bill 2718 are needed so that the small estates procedure can be more frequently used. The Marion County Clerk feels that the proposed increase in limits would simplify handling estates and relieve pressure on the probate court. He did say, however, that he had concern over the loss of revenue, as small estates are currently filed for $3.75, which is different from the minimum estate fee provided by law. Under present law, a $30,000 estate, which is probated, would pay a fee of $60 according to the sliding scale. Possibly the committee might wish to increase the filing fee for small estates, since the $375 presently allowed does seem a bit unrealistic. I think this varies from county to county, however. The cost of handling the small estate is certainly less than the cost of probate to the counties. Senate Bill 608 would establish new probate fees somewhat higher than those presently set by law. In summary, I would suggest that House Bill 2718 would provide benefits to those citizens involved in closing small estates by saving them the expense of court appearances through attorneys and the greater delays necessary with probate proceedings. It would benefit the counties by reducing the number of probate proceedings with a consequent saving in cost. Thank you.
Okay, I'm Francis Smith. My office is at 740 Jackson Tower in Portland, which I share with Norman, who had just spoken. I would certainly concur in the concept of this amendment. I do so without any equivocation. I noted Norm's statement that much of this could be done without attorneys, which is very true. I would suggest, however, that in most cases, I think that on these small estates, that the people would
engage the services of an attorney, but at a cost of possibly $100 or some very reasonable amount. And I'm thinking of a specific case that went through our office just a very short time ago. It was relatively simple. The people were completely without any idea as to where to get started. It was kind of a holding of hands type of thing. But nevertheless, with this, I think that the total billing was $110, something like that. It was a very amount. They were thrilled to death to know that the thing was closed and that there was not a long probate necessary. It was just an ideal example of what this would do. We, of course, did not have to get involved in a lot of appraisals to determine what the values were, but it would have been I would think, appraised out at maybe the $20,000 figure. So the $30,000 aggregate, with $20,000 of it being real property, is certainly a realistic look at this. As Norm mentioned, even the a 50-by-100 or smaller residence lot now in the anywhere from $10,000 on up, regardless of what part of the city or the community it's in, would make this $20,000, I think, a very realistic figure. I would also like to comment only to the matter of the fees. I would concur that the $375 is not probably an adequate fee if this thing goes up. All the mechanical processes within the probate clerk's office, one thing or another, I think would justify an increase in those fees. I would probably feel that maybe on any of these small estate things that a fee of maybe $20 or $25, if we're up to an aggregate of $30,000, would not be at all unreasonable, and I'm sure that it would meet with absolutely no opposition as far as these people are concerned who would be able to take advantage of it. The increase in the dockets of the probate court, I think, require that something like this be done. Now, the first thing you know, that we're going to have the request in here for a second probate judge in Multnomah County. And there, of course, you're running into terrific sums of money, because not only new courtrooms, they can't even, well, they could squeeze people into the courthouse now, I think, with better judicious use of space, but another courtroom in itself is probably a couple hundred thousand bucks, the way they figure things. So anyway, I feel very strongly that the proposed legislation has merit. I think that the aggregate $30,000 is a very realistic figure.
Mr. Chairman, in your practice, what would be the amount of small estate that you or any of the people you know professionally would deal with? It's easy to see or to think about an estate with any real property at all having a value of in the range of $20,000, but what's a small one? Do you see any that have assets of $3,000,
$4,000? Well, yes, and in fact, actually, where that comes in so frequently is a checking account, a bank account, a savings account, and one of the savings and loans or something like that that has not been put into a joint name. Maybe there's no close relative. I think this is where you would run into it most frequently. Not so much in real property. But even if kind of interesting you will find that the average person following a death, a family member or a close friend, whatever it might be, is just at a loss to know where to start in. And this is where they will generally contact an attorney. We had a call just yesterday morning. Now, this will have to be a probate estate, although when this woman called, she had no idea. She said, "I don't even know where to start. The funeral was 2 weeks ago, about 10 days ago." Not even knowing where to start. So there we will probate. But if this had been a smaller estate, you could have led her through, help her with the affidavit, one thing or another, maybe the cost of $100, and that's it.
Okay, that question was a setup for the next question, which is, if we just have one filing fee, and let's say it is $25, in your opinion, would that be a fair fee, even if the estate were only a couple of $1,000?
I would really think so, because when you think of the procedural steps that the thing has to go through and recording and all that, and the cost, I don't think would be prohibitive. It certainly is not an unreasonable figure. I wouldn't feel,
I wouldn't
at least.
Either, but
Mr. Chairman, two quick matters. First of all, since I do on occasion receive a small estate and I practice in this area, I should probably declare a conflict, although it's not a major portion of my practice. Secondly, we received a phone message just now from Ed Morgan, who is the Marion County Clerk, who indicates that he cannot be here to testify this morning. However, he supports this bill and Senate Bill 151. He does have a suggested change which relates to making the small estate fee $25. Thank you very much.
Thank you both very much. Mr. McManaman?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bob McMahon. I practice law in Portland at 729 Southwest Alder Street. This bill basically was introduced at the request of my assistant, who has to do a good part of my probate work, and she decided that, frankly, it was getting too expensive for our clients, and at the same time, the law firm is losing money on them. I am sure that you, as a practicing lawyer, remember the old shibboleth that you would lose your shirt on the small estates and make it up on the big ones when we had our percentage rules that on fees. Unfortunately, in Multnomah County anyway, we do no longer have a percentage rule on fees, and we still lose our shirts on the small estates, and we do not make it up on the big ones. This particular bill, I think, is very important because the consumer movement and the newspapers these days are full of the problems of the deliveries of legal services and the fact that the lawyers are overpricing the market. The idea and the dream of this bill was to allow a method whereby on a small estate it could be handled in an expeditious manner at a reasonable cost. Now, I know that lawyers are still not getting paid reasonable fees in the small estates. I don't think they expect to. This is more or less a pro bono work on their part. However, from the standpoint of a deceased person, the heirs, it's very important because many times this problem arises because there's been a goof up in the estate planning. Normally, you'll have between a husband and wife, everything will be in joint name, and you won't have a small estate that you have to go to court or even undergo under this bill. But many times you will have the bank account, you'll have a fractional interest in real property. Recently, we run into quite a bit of it where they own a percentage right in the old family land back in Oklahoma where they hope to find an oil well, or they've got it in Texas, or they've got a fractional interest in a beach lot at Longview, Washington. We seem to run into these things quite a bit. And to raise the limit to $30,000, I think, is just plain common sense with the inflation and the problems we have. Actually, if my personal preference would be to raise it to about $50,000, but I think $30,000 is a step up. I'd like to point out one what I consider inconsistency in the bill, and that's where we talk about the personal property, we talk about fair market value, then we talk about real property, we talk about the appraised value. It would seem to me to make much more sense to refer to both of them on the basis of fair market value. Otherwise, that you could interpret the fact that you would have to have a formal appraisal each time of real property, which would add an additional expense to the handling of the small estate. I don't think it's necessary. As a practical matter, I'm sure you and I and Norm, what we've done is somewhat use the assessed value as a fair market value, and we, I'm sure, can get by with that, but it's not the technically appraised value. I don't want to stray over into this other Senate bill too much. However, it does affect drastically the terms of the House bill, and I'm afraid that the Senate bill, if it were allowed in full as presented, would destroy most of the effect of the House bill. What it does is put back in many of the features of a full-dress probate, give us additional time, wait 4 months for this, list all creditors, pay bill. I think that the small estates are well protected by the present statute, plus I believe the executor des own tort statute is still on the books, whereby if a person steals or takes money out of a small estate, that they're liable for double the value of what they take. And I think that is ample protection by itself. So I think that this bill to go to 30,000 is great. If the committee could see its way to go to 50,000, I'd like it even better. And to reiterate, I'd like to see it based on fair market value. And then if I could, I'd like to turn it over to a young lady who has been in my office for 23 years, knows much more about this than I do. And Joanne is the one who said, hey, this is costing clients too much, let's do something about it.
Right. We'll call her as a witness, but we have some people call too.
Fine, I think she's next on the list. So.
Well, that's fine. William Dobson, speaker.
Mr. Chairman, I think I'll defer speaking against the bill at this time, since I'm here on 151 and don't kind of...
You're not going to speak on the bill then?
Not on the House bill, no.
Okay. Joanne Lippert?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Joanne Lippert. I'm employed as a legal assistant by Bob McMiniman of the firm of McMiniman, Joseph, Harrell, and Paulson. My concern was, or is, that a number of the common people with few assets or not many assets are being caught up in the paperwork of what goes on in a full-blown probate. I think we agree that there's a need, however it's done by probate or otherwise, to accomplish the orderly transfer of assets to the heirs without excessive paperwork. But when there are a few assets, I don't think that we can justify asking these people to go through that, particularly at a time in their life where they've lost someone and it's very difficult for them to cope with government and the business aspects of transferring these assets. Probate requires certain appearances before judges, and that requires attorneys to go to court to do that. In the small estate statute, most of the paperwork can be done by legal assistants or other staff in the office, which reduces the cost to the consumer, which is really what we're talking about today, is doing something to benefit the consumer who needs somehow to transfer these assets. Lawyers have to charge clients for the time they spend doing whatever they do for those clients. So whatever can be done within the statute to arrange things so that it can be done in an orderly fashion by the people themselves or by with the help of a lawyer's office to reduce paperwork will benefit the consumer. I think that when we're talking about passing laws, that's what we should be talking about, is laws that will benefit the consumer, and I think the small estate statute would do that. I think that I agree with Mr. McMiniman that $30,000 is realistic, but somewhere along the line we may be needing to think about a higher amount with the inflation the way it has gone, because there are total of $30,000 in this day and age is not considered a lot of money, I don't believe. And I believe with the notices that are required in the small estate statute to the Department of Revenue and to the Welfare Department or Adult Family Services, I believe that those agencies are protected and that there's no reason we can't try to speed things along. With the inflation the way it's going, fewer people are able to take advantage of the small estate statute. Because, as I said, $30,000 really isn't very much, and I think, or as it stands now, it's very little, and $30,000 really isn't that much either.
John, how do you feel about raising the filing fee?
Well, that's something I really hadn't considered too much before this morning. Personally, I believe filing fee should cover the cost of processing the paperwork to the county. In other words, the county should be able to charge. You know, they really shouldn't have to take a loss on the thing. I would think $25. Which was discussed earlier would be reasonable.
First question for witness. Thank you. Carl Brenner.
West. I'm Carl Brenner, fiscal manager for the Division of State Lands, and I have with me Wes Robinson, who is the probate agent for the Division of State Lands. And as you may be well aware or not aware, under the Oregon Constitution, Article 8, Section 2B, all proceeds of estates where there are no heirs go to the common school fund. And we probate something like 80 or 85 different estates, a year, many of them being small estates. And our concern has been that, and that's one of the reasons for 151, and I'll just mention it, that the division be recognized as the divisee or the heir in the case of missing heirs, that the division of state lands and the common school fund be recognized. We have no problem with 2718. I think I have to agree with all those that have testified that with the high cost of inflation, that $10,000, $20,000 or $30,000 isn't a big estate any longer. And the more probate that you have to go through and the court appearances or production of numerous numbers of records and so forth is costly. And so you eat up a large amount of the estate. And I know from our own experiences in the office, if we have to appear at court and hire the Attorney General to represent us, our costs go up. So if we can do it in the small estate fashion, it's saving everybody. In case an heir should be found later, the residual left of the small estates he's going to get, because he can claim that from the Division of State Lands for 10 years. The division, however, is concerned if you pass 2718 that you also pass Senate Bill 151. We feel that it's imperative that Senate Bill 151 be passed, because it provides certain protections for heirs that can't be found at the time. And we're talking about raising an estate to $30,000, and one or two of the heirs can be located. And unless we allow, say, 4 months, or that the division be notified in case there are missing heirs, that we protect the assets of those unknown parties. So I think it's imperative that Senate Bill 151 has to be passed if you're going to raise the fees under 2718. I might just make a comment. We do probate work in all of the 36 counties, and the fees do vary. West, don't they run about $10 average? Some counties are less, some counties are more. We have no problem with the $25 fee either, Mr. Chairman.
Do you have anything to answer?
No, the $10.50 is about the cost of the court cost to most of our small estates throughout the area.
Questions for witnesses? Thank you both, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 2718? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2718 and move on to Senate Bill 151. Mr. Dobson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is William Dobson. I'm manager of the Estate Administration Unit, Vet and Family Services Division. Senate Bill, well, first let me say that in all probability...
Give me just a second. I'm not finding that. Yeah.
Heather, have you got your Senate Bill book? Either of you? I know you're using your bill folders, so it doesn't make a difference.
Yeah. I have an extra copy of the bill.
Okay.
The Adult and Family Services Division is a creditor in the state of a deceased welfare recipient for the amount of assistance provided to them during their lifetime under certain programs. And so as a creditor of the estate, we probably have as much to do with the Small Estate Act as anyone else in the state of Oregon. The statute requires that the division be provided a copy of the Small Estate Affidavit when it's filed. And when we receive a copy of this, we match it with persons who have known to have been receiving public assistance. And in those cases where the person, the decedent, has received public assistance, the Adult Family Services Division files a claim in that estate. Under the Small Estate Act, well, let me say this first. The purpose of the Senate Bill 151 is that it requires a person filing a small affidavit to hold the property for a period of 4 months so that persons who have claims against the estate may have sufficient time, as in a regular estate, to file a claim. It also requires Section 151 also requires that the affidavit list the known deaths of the decedent. The present status of the statute is that the affiant must state that there are no known deaths of the decedent, and which in a lot of cases is not true. This way, it will allow them to file an affidavit and still comply with the law by listing the known deaths. Otherwise, it would technically preclude a person from filing an affidavit because of the fact there are outstanding debts, or he would have to pay the debts first before he could file an affidavit. We feel that the current assessed value of property should be changed to the appraised value of the property, the same as any estate, and especially if the house bill was passed, raising the limits to $30,000, or $20,000 real property, $10,000 personal property. The affidavit also requires the, or Senate Bill 151 also requires that the claiming successor pay claims of creditors within the 4-month period of time. And if they are not paid, it authorizes the creditor, as same as it would in a regular estate, to petition directly to the court for a summary determination of his claim. I don't believe that these are things that will cause any problems with the administration of a small estate. Presently, the only remedy you have is either to file a regular probate, which we have had to do in many cases, or a regular lawsuit against the claiming successor or the person who has received the funds. We find that in 50% of the small estates that are filed with us, distribution of the assets of the estate has occurred within a relatively short time after the affidavit has been filed. And by the time that we present a claim, the funds are gone. The claiming successor has distributed the funds, and quite often it occurs that it's in Washington, California, and so on, and we are unable to recover on our claim. If we know that this is going to happen and we are able to, we will file a regular probate to supersede the small estate. But lots of times it's legal problems, and then it doesn't, we really don't have enough time to do that. So we are losing money, the state is losing money, by having distribution made prior to the 4-month period within which we have our claim filed. Under the present probate law, the Adult and Family Services Division, the Assistant Director of the Adult and Family Services Division, is authorized to act as personal representative of an estate, or his designated representative, of which I am the designated representative. If we would permit Senate Bill 151 to go through, this would allow the Assistant Director of the Adult and Family Services Division to also act as a claiming successor. The purpose of this, the main purpose of this, is that there are many estates that are in the neighborhood of $250 to $500, or $800 even, that it is not economically feasible to file a regular probate. These occur when there is an underpayment of Social Security, underpayment of SSI. We are already able to obtain bank accounts from the banks, so the bank problem, obtaining bank accounts, is no problem for the division. Quite often there are money orders, and so that the recipients have, and if they haven't cashed, and permitting the adult, permitting the assistant director to act as a claiming successor would allow us to recover these funds without the necessity of a regular probate.
Questions? Yeah. A couple of them. I want to review for a second.
Chairman, first one, Richard. What were the comments in the Senate committee that heard this bill about the 4-month waiting period? Wouldn't that cause a hardship on some heirs?
No, not at all. The regular probate proceedings now require a 4-month waiting period.
They do?
Yes, they do.
Okay, my question was on point two of your testimony. You state that the present form requires the affiant to say that there are no known debts. I assume that that structure presupposes that he finds out about the debts, pays them off, and then says, now there are no more known debts. Under your system, he would find out about the debts at some point, either before or after filing the affidavit, and pay them. So it comes out about the same place, doesn't it? Only the existing law, I suppose, presupposes that he pays first and files the affidavit second. And yours presupposes that he files the affidavit first and pays second.
Yes.
Any improvement?
Technically, they wouldn't be able to file an affidavit if there are any outstanding debts. Unless he pays them first.
He's supposed to pay. So you imply a criticism of the existing law by saying that it requires almost a false swearing. But does it really? Because under the existing law, he's supposed to pay them and swear truly that there are no more debts. Isn't that correct?
Well, the existing law doesn't say he has to pay them before he can file. The existing law says that he shouldn't file unless there are no debts.
Okay.
And
I guess what it boils down to is you feel that your structure that you're setting up
It makes it better and easier for a person to file, a claiming successor to file the affidavit.
Mr. Chairman, Dennis, I ran into that dilemma about a year ago in one of these cases. The thing that bothered me in filing the affidavit for one of the heirs was that we had to scrounge every possible place looking for a potential debt before we could get this proceeding underway. And I suppose the delay caused was several months just looking for debt before we could file the affidavit to get the 4 months to start running.
Okay, so there is a benefit then.
I wondered why at the time the statute didn't say just list the known debts in the affidavit, proceed from there, and swear that you intend to pay them or deny them, whatever the case. But I found that to be kind of an anomaly.
Second question. Should a copy of the affidavit be sent to the creditors, or it says here make every reasonable effort to ascertain the creditors, but I don't see any requirement that you communicate with creditors once you figure out who they are. Am I missing something?
Actually I have thought about that, but that I don't think it's necessary, because I think when this affidavit is filed with the court, it's constructive notice to the creditor that there is a probate in proceedings and that he has 4 months to file the claim.
Is it perhaps picked up down in Section 4 under which the affiant is required to pay the creditors? That's paying, I suppose, is the most direct form of notification, to send him his money.
That would be true, yeah.
I guess I'm just questioning how much information you give to the creditor in addition to, let's say, a check for the debt, whether there's any other need of information, a copy of the affidavit or anything else.
I wouldn't think that would be necessary.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, one of my own questions about the procedure, and I guess I can answer this before we go to work session, is how does a creditor who is unknown to the affiant discover, other than through constructive notice, that there may be funds with which to pay the debt, so that an old hospital bill or an old phone bill that's outside the county in which the small estate proceeding is filed, I don't really know how you find that. I guess it depends on the intent of probate. But whether a simple publication should be required on something like this, the more things you do like that, the more you diminish the value of the small estate.
Right.
But it's not intended to deny a creditor his lawful dues.
Further questions?
That's the way the situation is now. No credit, unless the creditor checks with the courthouse, like a hospital, for instance, checks the courthouse periodically to determine, which is what we do also, to determine if there has been a small estate filed, the creditor just won't know about it. But, like Representative Smith said, if you keep adding things to this, then you're going to be right up to a regular probate again.
Okay. Another one for work there. No problem.
Okay. Further questions for witness? Thank you, sir. Carl Brennan?
I won't take much more of the committee's time. As I said when I was testifying on 2718, I feel that Senate Bill 151 is necessary, and the provisions, the 4 months' notice, I don't think is unreasonable. It doesn't prevent the spouse or the children of getting money to carry them just like they would in a normal probate. We're not asking for anything more in a small estate than trying to simplify it. But we want to protect the assets long enough that creditors and other persons who might be interested in the estate have a chance to make their claim before it is all distributed. As far as the debts, I think this is a reasonable way to do it. Multnomah County, I know, will accept an affidavit if you list them and don't necessarily pay them. And we have a problem in the Division of State Lands using the small estate because of the current law that you have to pay them. And we can't commingle funds. In other words, I can't use somebody else's estate money to pay this estate. So what it does, we have a $500 small estate or $1,000, and we have to then file a full probate because we can't get a hold of a nominal amount of money to pay a $5 telephone bill that we're aware of. And so the fact that we can list them under the 151 provision means that we can get the affidavit, obtain the cash, and now pay the bill. This simplifies it much easier.
Questions for the witness? Thank you. Mr. McKinnon, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to say I've had a chance now to reread Senate Bill 151, and I think, frankly, it's a typical bureaucratic response of using a sledgehammer to drive home a tack. I think the entire problem is taken care of by the present bill and with the amendments we're thinking about under the House bill. But this Senate Bill 151 is designed to more or less say that you don't trust the person who's filing the affidavit and that obviously he's going to be dishonest, so therefore you have to come up with all these special features. I think they're ridiculous, and I think that you can rely upon the affidavit and the honesty of the person presenting it, and that does take care of the problems. Representative Richards mentioned or asked the question whether this could be a hardship upon the heirs, perhaps a widow or the children. I think it could be a severe hardship. In some small estates I've handled, if people could not get their inheritance for a four-month period, they're going to starve to death during the interval. And frankly, we have a hell of a time trying to get Social Security or something moving. Now, many...
Excuse me, Bob, yes. Interrupting. I wanted to ask you, or Joanna, what is the law with regard to paying the support of the widow and children, or the spouse and children, as it relates to small estates?
Under the present small estate, I think you could pay it immediately, but you'd have to also pay the bills. Under 151, as I read it, you could not pay support to the wife and the children.
Which, by statute, is allowed...
Under the major estate. So what you'd have to do, I think if you pass Senate Bill 151 and you had a shortage of money, you would have to file a full-blown probate just to get some money to the widow.
Mr. Chairman, could you, under 151, merely put the widow or the spouse and children as priority above the creditors?
I would say not.
Wipe out the estate.
I would say not the way the thing is written. I certainly agree with one of the other speakers that the more you amend this, the more you're taking yourself right back into a full estate statute. And I think you're destroying the entire purpose of the Small Estate Act. I want to go back to the original concept of the Small Estate Act and go with it and trust in the honesty of the person making the affidavit and say that they lied or made a mistake, go back after the person who made that affidavit. Don't go through all these extra steps.
You had a comment, sir? You have to identify yourself and state
your question. I'm Bill Dobson, State Administration Unit.
Okay.
All I wanted to do was clarify as to when
property could pass under the Small Estate Act, and the Small Estate Act says that title to the property does not pass or vest into the persons entitled to it under the affidavit until 4 months. Even though the property is generally all distributed prior to that time, but technically title does not pass until 4 months.
Okay.
Four.
Yes, sir.
The division, I'm Carl Brenn again, Chairman. The reason the division is concerned with 151 is not so much of the 4 months. I mean, we're concerned that people become aware that the Division of State Lands is responsible for those estates where there are no heirs. And we've had many cases where funeral homes and others have tried to file an affidavit and get the proceeds of the estate, and they're not an heir, they're not a devisee, they have no legal entitlement. What we're trying to do is make it aware within statute, recognize that that's our main concern with 151.
Is there anyone else here to testify? Come on.
I'm Joanne Lippert again, and I would like to respond to the comments about the questions about finding creditors and so forth and amending this to take care of all those people. And I agree that we may be entering an area of overkill. The problems with creditors and amounts of creditors and finding them and so on and so forth in our office generally has not arisen in those situations involving small estates. There, this comes up in either larger estates or situations which are complicated enough already that you have to file a probate. And those are the situations where we're trying to find creditors and resolving those problems. In the small estate situations, the ones that we have had are always small. They're people who have few assets, also have few bills, if any bills, and I think these are the people that we're trying to help or should be trying to help, and not complicating their lives with a lot of unnecessary paperwork, because I don't think that is the average situation that we're talking about here in a small estate.
Let me ask you a question. What percentage of the small estates that you handle have you had creditors contact you, say, after the proceeds have been distributed?
I can't recall that it's ever
happened.
I can't recall that. Because generally we don't try to, if there's any question about whether or not it would fit, I mean, we would put it into a probate situation. We don't try to shove something into a small estate that belongs somewhere else, and we just never run into any problems.
Anyone else testify on Sentinel 151?
If not,
can I have one question?
I don't mean to drag this up. Mr. McMillan.
Yes.
The thrust of your comments were that on page 3, lines 28 to 31, the language, the person filing the affidavit shall not cause any payment to delivery or transfer within 4 months. That should be deleted.
Absolutely.
Okay. If it's deleted, then there would be allowance to transfer the property, let's say, to the whoever, and the rest of the bill would indicate that the person to whom the property was transferred would be liable for the claim against the property, right?
I think that'd be the answer under existing law.
Okay, is that would that be a greater hardship? Let's say if I were the recipient, would it be a greater hardship on me to receive the property than have to give it up again than to never have received it at all?
That's where I think you get into your overkill. I think the situation you say, what would be the greater hardship? I believe that it would not happen 1 out of 1,000 times that you would get something and have to give it back.
Okay.
And, you know, you could make up rules and regulations all day long.
Fine.
And sometimes you could have 100 pages of safeguards, but all you're doing is fouling up the process and not delivering proper legal services.
Good. I don't want you to drag out your answer, Mark.
I have one question. Do you see any problem in allowing the Division of State Lands to be a claim?
Not at all.
Okay.
Not at all. I think I would interpret the present bill that they could come in under.
We do.
Yeah, and they say they do. So
we do, but we just have a problem with the public being notified. This is a way of making it in fact recognized.
Well, okay.
I think you have to take some liberty with it. That present bill is so short and so simple that you have to kind of give it your own interpretation as you go along. And I see nothing wrong with that. I think it needs to be flexible.
Thank you. Okay, we do have a sudden form. I guess we could basically take some action at this point. We'll close the public hearing on
Senate Bill 151. We'll now move to the work session on Council Bill 2718.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to consider Mr. McLuhan's testimony regarding fair market value being the value used for both. If I recall, historically, this was a change, the current law was a change from last session, and I'm just checking my notes of why we moved to the appraised value.
I think there was some concern in the committee. I was on the committee at that time about requiring appraisal in cases of real property, and that real property was generally had, you know, much more value than perhaps it used to have. Prices rising, and there should be appraisal done. I think that's why the language was added. That's at least the rationale that comes to mind.
I understand that rationale. I'm just wondering if it doesn't fly in the face of the concept of small estate, however, if we have to get a formal appraisal and spend $50 to $75 right off the top to have a licensed realtor or appraiser come out just to even look at it, a full appraisal would be $250.
Yes, a motion, Representative.
I'll move that we change in line 7 of House Bill 2718 the word appraised to fair market value, I believe. Okay. Having a fair market value.
Chairman?
Representative Richard.
Would we also need to make that change on line 6?
Yes.
Okay, Representative Smith has moved in line 6 of the bill where the word appraised appears to be stricken, and the word fair market value is inserted, and also on line 7. Is there discussion?
I believe, Mr. Chairman, that would require also deleting the and in front of the word appraised.
Okay, we'll include that in the motion. Is there further discussion? Is there objection? Hearing none, it's forward.
I'm tempted, Mr. Chairman, to increase the amount of the estate, but I think I'm going to leave it at the $30,000 aggregate. It would be more acceptable to the larger group of legislators.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Richard?
I don't know of a single family house in the state of Oregon, unless it's pretty bad shape, that's selling for $20,000.
If I could respond to that.
Please.
Mr. Chairman, I think that that's a realistic statement, Representative Richards, but what we're running into, as the testimony revealed, is maybe a partial interest in a lot someplace, or even a whole interest in a very small parcel of land that $5,000 or $10,000 certainly would be unrealistic, but $20,000 would cover that in most cases. I think when you get into a situation where the family home is involved, if it's not a jointly held asset, then it probably is subject to probate, and you're getting into a much greater value, and it takes it out of the concept of small estate. Chances are that it's not by probate anyway if there's a husband and wife situation.
Okay. Did you have a motion on the fee? Excuse me, Representative Richards, something further?
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate some enlightenment from the committee members or council about the function of providing a real property small estate provision, if, you know, how it relates to the single family home, the principal place of residence of the decedent. What's the function of the small estate provision? Is it to reach that home?
Representative Richards, in the last one that I handled involving two orphaned girls, basically all that was involved was the personal property in a rental house, a couple hundred dollars in a checking account, and I believe that there was a tax refund owing to the deceased, and that was it. And there was no real property involved. Had the home that was being rented been owned by the decedent, it would have clearly taken this matter into a $40,000 range. And probably at that point, as I say, you might wonder if you shouldn't probate that, if there were no will and it wasn't clear to whom the asset should go. So I don't think the family home is in this concept. I don't think it can be a good dollar figure. I admit that.
No, I would agree with you. I think that there are some differences between the small estates provision and the regular probate, that particularly in the distribution of the assets and when the assets can be distributed, that provide probably a little more protection to creditors. And we have to make the policy decision at which point we're going to trigger that in. And I would be a little wary of going much above $30,000 or going above $30,000 to do that.
And in both the answers, I haven't heard what the overriding policy issue is that precludes a value that would allow a single family home in principal place of residence to go through the small estate proceeding.
There's nothing that deals specifically, Representative Richards, with the value of the home itself.
Or
we're talking about
substantively either.
Well, we're talking about protection of creditors, I think. And also the sizes of obligations. If people have more assets, they generally have larger liabilities. Is there any further motion? Representative Smith?
Line 13 of the bill, Mr. Chairman. That sentence should read, the county clerk may charge not more than $25 as the for filing the affidavit.
Okay, Representative Smith has moved in line 13 of the bill that the language that the clerk may charge not more than $25 for filing fee for a small estate. Is there discussion? Is there objection?
Representative
Richards?
Wish the maker of the motion to speak to the motion.
Representative Smith?
Yeah, Representative Richards, we had comments, at least I took comments prior to hearing from a number of the county clerks and probate administrators. The fee varies around the state. I believe one witness said as much as $10.50 would be the small estate filing fee. Currently, an estate above a small estate,
mm-hmm.
and one that is in the $30,000 range, would fit into the minimum probate schedule of fees for the county clerks can file. Right now, that would be a $60 filing fee for a $30,000 estate. It's a revenue loss to the county. And Ed Morgan, who is the county clerk in Marion County, asked that we consider charging a flat fee or something in the range of $25 for a state that could be as high as $30,000. And testimony this morning supported that as a generally fair fee for what the county actually has to perform in these small states.
Further discussion on the motion. Is there objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's ordered. Are there further motions on House Bill 2718 as amended?
Mr. Chairman.
Lieutenant Smith.
Move House Bill 2718 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Smith has moved that House Bill 2718 be sent to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Cullen. Aye, with a reservation, and I want to, I'll hear it in full committee, but I think it ought to go.
Richards?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Rogers?
Aye. Passes. We'll now move to Senate Bill 151.
I have two suggestions just to move things along. Number one, on page 2, line 16, after the word representative, I suggest a deletion at the end of the line because, technically speaking, it's superfluous as part of a definition. That business about may act as an affiance isn't part of the, stylistically, part of the proper definition.
Dennis, could you point to that out again?
Line 16, the language may act as the affiant. I, in my opinion, shouldn't be part of the definition because the language up to that implies that, and it's superfluous.
Mr. Chairman, do we have copies of the Mayor Gross bill?
I do.
In the bill book?
Yes, I do.
Well, take it over to him. That's good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
going to be from here.
Everyone have a copy of the bill?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Dennis?
I'm suggesting that, that as a motion, in case any of you want to make
it. I'll make a motion. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith moves in page 2, line 15, that after Representative Restline be stripped, their discussion, their objection, turn that forward.
And then, just to move it along, if the committee is interested in Mr. McMinniman's suggestion and testimony, on page 3, lines 28 to 31, that sentence encompassed within those lines would be deleted. I think that's all you'd have to do to meet his concern.
Okay, the chair would move, and on page 3, line 28, after language RS 115.125, that the rest of the line, lines 29, 30, and 31 be stricken. Is there discussion? Is there objection?
One moment, Mr. Chairman, if I may. Thank you.
Is there objection?
Objection?
Hearing none, so ordered. You got a comment, sir?
Yes, sir.
Talk to the microphone.
This is one of the problems that we are having with this. In my prior testimony, I indicated that at least 50% of the affidavits that we received, that wherein we file claims, or the claiming assessment, the money has already been distributed. And part of this bill is to increase the recoveries and claims against the state to $100,000 by prohibiting this type of distribution of the assets of the estate. The bill right now says that title does not pass until 4 months. And if you look at that, that implies that you wouldn't be able to distribute it with 4 months anyway, but people do. And the reason for putting this in is to simply state that the person filing the affidavit can't distribute for 4 months.
Well, I guess the crux of the matter is that the committee, at this point anyway, is taking the position that we don't want to hold up the distribution of assets in every estate, you know, because of the problems that you may have in a very small number of estates.
Well, it's not just the state of Oregon, Mr. Chairman. It's every dying creditor. I have some examples right here. An affidavit was filed recently. The whole darn estate was distributed the day after the affidavit was filed. And the people are all over the place. We've had one recently in Coos Bay where there was a $5,000 bank account. And all of the claiming successor was from Washington. He had an attorney in Coos Bay. And the attorney in Coos Bay filed the affidavit and got the money from the bank and distributed it in the state and other creditors. The state had a $3,000 claim in that, and there were other creditors too, and nobody got paid.
Well, I'm a little nervous about taking any kind of firm decision on this at this point with the information that we have. I think that in any system that you have of this kind, there are going to be people who are not going to get paid because there may be a creditor who will surface after 4 months and after the property's been distributed. Okay, so there's really a policy decision on the part of this committee and the legislature as to, you know, how involved and how complicated are we going to make the process and how do we balance, you know, the rights of creditors vis-a-vis the need for people to have the property distributed. And I would suggest that you provide whatever information you have regarding the amount of loss to the state, and it also will have some members of the committee and perhaps staff doing some investigation or a poll as to what problems there seems to be as far as creditors just generally out among the populace and the administration of these estates, and this matter will be carried over.
Thank you.
Is there objection with that from the committee?
I provide this with...
Please, Mr. Chairman. President Smith. Either at a later date or now, I would ask that we make Senate Bill 151 consistent with House Bill 2718 and those amendments that we just added regarding fair market value versus appraised or assessed value.
If the bill comes out of the committee, that I'm sure will be an amendment that will be received without any problem. Is there further business to come before the subcommittee? If not, we're adjourned.